At one time, the country believed itself to be the true face of Australia. Sunburnt men and capable women, raising crops and children, enduring isolation and a fickle environment, carrying the nation on their sturdy backs. Is that the case now? Does the city need the country? Does Australia rely on the country for its national image? I'm Matt Smith, and this is the La Trobe University podcast. Judith Brett is a professor of politics at La Trobe University and an award-winning author. In issue 42 of the Quarterly Essay, she looked at the relationship between country and city in Australia.
In the past, probably up until Second World War, the country was really important for Australia's idea of itself, and it was important for supporting the Australian economy. And because of that, the country had a really important place in all Australians' understanding of what the Australian nation was. And I think there was three reasons for this. One was Australia rode on the sheep's back. That is, most of our export income was earned from wool. And that made the Australian economy a very prosperous economy in the 19th century and into the 20th century. And a lot of the jobs in the city depended, in fact, on the exporting of that wool to the world. The second reason was that we had this big empty continent, and we needed to make good our claim to be a nation for a continent, and we wanted to fill it up with people. So the government had lots of schemes to make people live in the countryside, to get them out of the cities and into the country where they could be, you know, healthy and strong and independent. And the third reason is that when Australia thought about what is it about us that makes us different as a nation, they thought it's our environment, or in those days they would have said it's the land, and it's the people who are on the land, who are in many ways the people who've been made what they are by Australia, by the Australian environment. And so the country became really important culturally to give us images of what it was to be an Australian rather than, say, a New Zealander or an American or, most importantly, an Englishman.
So that shows a country that's very reliant on the country and on the image it provides and on the resources that it has. Is that still the case today?
No, it isn't. And I think that's been a really huge change over the last half a century. And it really sped up in the 1980s. I think if you look now, agriculture, not just wool, I mean, wool has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk as part of our export income. But agriculture is now about 15% of our export income, whereas 19th century it was like 90%. The country has been losing population relative to the city for a long time until about the 1970s. It's reversed a little bit, but a lot of the people living outside of the capital cities have gone to the coastal fringes, Queensland, New South Wales. So they're not living in the capital cities, but they're not exactly living in rural agricultural areas. And thirdly, I think Australian cities have become more confident that there's something distinctively Australian about our Australian cities. I mean, it used to be the case that people would say, look, cities are the same the world over. Sydney, Melbourne, just provincial cities, not enormously different from Birmingham or Manchester or Chicago. But now Australian cities, particularly Melbourne and Sydney, are really confident. They say there's something distinctive about our multicultural mix. And there's something about that that's Australian in the way in which we've brought people from four corners of the world, and we've created a sort of cosmopolitan Australianness. And the country is, by contrast, seen as full of sort of backward people. Not all of them, obviously, but, you know, the Pauline Hanson phenomenon came along in One Nation. You saw a lot of this imagery of the country is full of sort of rednecks and racists, and they were homophobic, they were xenophobic. So Australian cities are now much more confident, and the country's been sort of treated as if it's a bit backward.
During the election in 2010, the balance of power was held by three independents who were based in country areas. How did that bring the country debate and country issues back to the forefront?
Well, I think it did because all of a sudden people were really interested in Tony Windsor, Bob Katter and Rob Oakeshott. Normally the independents don't get much airplay. All of a sudden they were on our televisions, on our radios all the time, and they were giving the arguments about the country. They were giving a country viewpoint about the way the country saw itself. I mean, the city hadn't really heard the country arguing its case on primetime television for a long time. And it was actually when I was watching that I got the idea to write this quarterly essay, because I was listening to them. And because I'm a historian, I sort of recognised the arguments, you know, their arguments had been being put in various forms for the last 100 years. But I was very aware when I read the commentary that other people, the journalists, the commentators, didn't really know where this was coming from. They didn't have a sense of the history of the country and the way it's always felt a bit aggrieved. It's always felt that if it doesn't stand up for itself, the people in the city and the politicians who are city-based will just ignore it.
But they're right there, though, aren't they?
They will just ignore it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. They are right. Mm. And they feel that they've been ignored, particularly after the 1980s when what we called in Australia economic rationalism, when economic rationalism came along, it was very much user pays. All the different parts of the nation have to pay their way, no more cross subsidies. And the country has always relied on cross subsidies. And so all of a sudden, people living in the country felt abandoned. They saw their services disappearing. They felt that government wasn't interested in them. It was very hard for farmers at that stage for a number of reasons. So there was a sense of grievance. And out of that, I guess, you know, comes a sense of frustration.
What was the outcome of the election from the country's standpoint then? Did they have their needs addressed?
Yeah, they did pretty well. There was an agreement with Regional Australia, or an agreement on Regional Australia, I can't remember what it's called now, in which regional issues, which is what rural issues are now called, the country is now called Regional Australia, they were put high on the government's agenda. They were given priority. They were given their own minister. So Simon Crean is the Minister for Regional Development. And, for example, in the last budget, regional education did well and got money, and money went into the university that's in Tony Windsor's electorate. And they got National Broadband Network, didn't they? The National Broadband Network is very much the government saying, here we are, Regional Australia, this is something for you. For Tony Windsor, that was a really, really high priority. And for the country, generally, telecommunications or communication system have always been a really high priority, because the sort of big problem for the country in Australia is it's a small population spread across huge distances. So access to good communication makes a really big difference to the quality of life for people outside of the capital cities. In that sense, they did get listened to.
You just said then, and it's a point that I think has been made before, that most of Australia's population is living on the coast, on the outer fringes.
Most of it lives in the capital cities.
Yeah, and it's 30% that are living in the country areas. Is that that's the amount used?
30% that are living outside of the capital cities. So a lot of that, though, will still be living on the coast.
So should we be maintaining the country image and the country areas, and should we be giving it this amount of resources and attention?
Well, that's a good question. There are two arguments, I think, that historically have been put about why we should be maintaining the levels of resources. The first is that Australia has always, since Federation, had a commitment to regional equality, to the idea that wherever you lived, as an Australian citizen, there should be access to uniformity of provision, that you should have some access as a citizen to healthcare, to education services, to communication services. And that's been a really important part of Australia's tradition of egalitarianism, that people in the country should have a fair share. Secondly, we are a nation for a continent, whether we like it or not. Now, it so happened that the continent we got is a pretty hard, arid continent. It's a pretty hard continent to inhabit. But we have claimed it, and we have to think quite hard about not just its sort of usefulness to us, but our responsibility, if you like, to that land. And the other thing is, we have people living in these places. They live there, they feel they're Australians, they feel they've made a contribution to the nation. The people in the cities or the city-based politicians can't just sort of turn their backs and say, well, changed our mind.
Is the traditional view of the country way of life still a valid stereotype? Do we still cling to that archetype?
Look, I think there's a bit of variation. There's still quite a lot of sympathy in the city for farmers and people living in the country. The thing is, the country is quite varied. When we talk about the country, which we don't do very much anymore, but when I was growing up, we did a lot, we're really thinking about the settled agricultural lands, the dry sheep wheat belt, the horticultural areas, the big country towns. There's big differences. There's the wine growing areas of Adelaide, the Barossa Valley in South Australia. There's far north Queensland. There's the dry sheep wheat belt running through New South Wales and Queensland. There's the coastal strip. There's quite a lot of difference. But there's still the problem of distance. Now, in some of these cases, the distances are huge. So there is, in a way, the whole outback area. Now, clearly, the outback has become probably more important over the last 20 or 30 years for Australia's image of itself than the old settled agricultural countryside has. So that people living in Alice Springs or the cattlemen are more iconic of Australia than, say, somebody who's growing cabbages in Werribee.
Those living in the cities today in Australia generally have little attachment or connection to country Australia. One of the things that came out during the election is that people living in the country generally have the perception that they're the lucky ones, that we're the people who are missing out. Is anybody going to win a debate like that? Who do you think are the real winners in Australia, the country or the city?
Well, I suppose I don't think it's really a matter of winners and losers. They win and lose on different things. People in the country, there is a sort of defensive pride. They will say, you know, we wouldn't live anywhere else and look at all you people all overcrowded in the city. And but what I suppose was wanting to bring out was that there's a long debate in Western culture between the country and the city is which is the best place to live. And there are pluses and minuses, if you like, for both. The country can be seen as a place that's closer to nature, that's simpler, that's more relaxing, that's more healthy, where you're more independent. Or it can be seen as a place that's backward, where you're isolated, full of sort of, you know, hayseeds and rural idiots. The city can be seen as a place which is more sophisticated, more modern, more interesting, more tolerant, or it can be seen as negatively as overcrowded. The image now would be, you know, too much traffic, crime, drugs, violence. The thing is, they're both a bit of a mix of both, but there's a conversation that goes on inside of Australia about country and city, and there's a political struggle over resources. Because, for example, with the national broadband network, probably going to be of a lot of benefit to people in the country, but people in the city could get access to those services a hell of a lot cheaper. You know, so there's a degree of cross-subsidy going on, and the people in the city think, well, what are we paying for? Why should we subsidise those people? And the people in the country say, well, you should subsidise us because we're Australians too, and we have a place in the nation.
Professor Judith Brett, thank you for your time today.
Okay.